to make maybe a little bit of an apology for those of you that are here to hear about corn. Scott Stewart, who's going to follow me in the presentation, is going to talk essentially about the exact same subject. He shared that his presentation with me, and I feel like Scott is fully covering this subject. So rather than duplicate that, I'm going to pull a switch and talk about something else that is a very recent issue and and needs to be discussed among this group. At the National ESA meeting, Dr. Bruce Tabashnik, Tim's department head, came to the meeting with a topic such as I did this time and said, here's my topic I was asked to speak on, but you know what, this is really what I want to talk about. And in essence, he began to lay out a scenario of why he believes that bollworms are resistant to Cry1AC. And this is all based upon, primarily based upon Dr. Luttrell's, Dr. Ali's from the University of Arkansas data. And Dr. Ali is going to speak a little bit later in more detail about their data, their monitoring data. But he made some pretty significant claims, obviously. Anytime anybody claims resistance to Cry1AC, you know, not only is it a scientific issue, a technical issue, potentially commercial issue, but it also can become a regulatory issue for us. And so I'm going to make a meager attempt to address why we don't think that's in fact the case. So basically, Dr. Tabashnik would not share his slide set with us. So a lot of what I'll speak relative to what he said was from my memory. Some of you in the audience were there as well, so you can keep me straight on this. So basically, his claim was, if you look just at the LC50 values that were generated early on in the baseline work that both Dr. Luttrell did and Stone and Sims did in the early 90s and even prior to that, you will see what this appears to be an apparent shift in LC50's increase. The other thing that he said was, the reason this makes sense is because it was consistent with his own modeling efforts that would predict resistance in 8 or 9 years, so he thought that's consistent with that. And the last point that I remember that he spoke to was that resistance had not occurred in North Carolina, primarily because of the additional refuge that occurred in that state via the research that's been done for natural refuge support. So bottom line is, you know, this is basically what I believe Bruce is going on. And I have to admit, I haven't, and I should mention that in his, what he has submitted for publication of this information into the Nature Biotech Journal, we've heard that it's been accepted. We don't know if it's when it's going to be released. And so there's some speculation on our part relative to exactly the nature of all of his data. But basically, as we understood it from his talk at the SA meeting, basically he's taking the early data that you see here, and this is the 1988-1992 data, this data developed by Stones and Sims, this data developed by Randy Luttrell, and you can see basically a similar level of response between these two studies. Quite a bit of variation in LC50, but we expect that with bollworm and Cry1AC. This was a selected colony that that Randy had at that time, which did show an elevated response. And if you just look at the numbers that have been generated since 2002, as we began to get back into looking at LC50s in the monitoring, you can see, you know, why there could be that interpretation of resistance. And I need to mention that between this time here and this time here, basically USDA was monitoring both species, bollworms and budworms, but they were doing this through the use of discriminating doses primarily. And so the results from the discriminating doses test did not indicate any resistance development between those two periods of time. So what explains this apparent shift in LC50s? Well, obviously resistance could explain it, and that's what's being contended. One of the things that's very important to understand is the very early work was done with purified protein, And, you know, we're talking about a decade and a half ago or even longer. So the quality of those particular proteins at that time, even though they were the best that we know now or then, we're not exactly sure exactly the nature of those proteins compared to what would be produced as a purified toxin today. And certainly the question of, you know, could there be some sort of protein degradation involved in some of these higher LC50s? Obviously, different labs, researchers, different times, you know, could explain some of this. One suggestion is maybe the work that Randy's and Dr. Ali have done here recently is just more fully explored the range of natural variation that occurs as opposed to there actually being some sort of shift. One thing that we do know is that we don't always get a consistent response associated with a genotype, particularly using these toxins and the boll worm. And so we see a lot of phenotypic variation from one strain to the next. And then, you know, who knows what other artifactual reasons there might be. So is resistance the most likely explanation for this shift? Well, the first thing I'd like to offer is evidence that no, that's not the case, is it doesn't really explain why we also saw a shift in the laboratory colonies in their response. Now, some of these laboratory colonies were generated from in the laboratory season after season. Some of them admittedly had to occasionally infuse wild individuals, wild strains into the colonies, which could have caused a shift upwards. But in the case of Dr. Luttrell's lab, they use a colony that's perpetuated internally, not infused with field males. So basically what I have here in this diagram is sort of a history of lab colony results in terms of LC50s. And you can see early on there was even a huge range from the Luttrell report from that initial work. But generally, we're talking about a range of one or two. If you look at the early years, Hardy did some work and saw a similar level there. But as you can see, as time moves on, and Dr. Blanco did some work reported in 2005, his results from lab colony baseline, you can see considerably higher than here. And that's pretty well been the case over time. So there's clearly been a shift in what we're seeing with lab colonies in terms of LC50s. well, what's been happening with tobacco budworm, and Carlos will be talking about that this afternoon as well. But it's interesting to note, again, if you just look at LC50s, and this is a history of the reported LC50s, both lab colonies and field colonies. And if you look at the earlier work, both from a lab colony standpoint as well as a field colony standpoint, you can see the responses that we were getting then. And if you fast forward to the more present time, you know, the 2002 beyond, you can see that the values that we're getting now are at least tenfold and sometimes manyfold greater than that with the tobacco budworm. Now, what doesn't really make a whole lot of sense is if we're still controlling tobacco budworm to a 100% level, which is what we believe we're doing, we've not been able to determine any survivors of tobacco budworms on any BT cotton. One would question, how do you get selection in this case, and why would you see this increase? Perhaps maybe the most important observation to associate with these LC50s is what's going on in the field. And in this situation, I got some assistance from John Van Dyne and J.R. Bradley looking at somewhat of a history of their work where they've had unsprayed Bollgard cotton without any treatments applied to it and followed boll damage associated with various levels of populations that have occurred from year to year. And the interesting thing to note in this is that even, you know, prior to the introduction of Bollgard cotton commercially, they could see damage levels as much as 32%, such as they saw in 1994. And you can see 75% damage in the non-BT, high population levels associated with that. But, of course, the year before, 75, a similar level of infestation, but only 19%. And you can see, again, in 1996, a fairly high level of mold damage had occurred. And primarily, this is toward the end of the season in either late August, early September, where they get traditionally heavy bollworm pressure in their cotton. And then finally in 2003, but if you look at these numbers, you know, from year to year, what you're going to see is a lot of variation. From a field performance standpoint, we just have no evidence at all that that any shift has occurred, at least to the extent that we've been able to see it or measure in the field. And if you look at the, just and Dr. Luttrell pulled this data out of his database, and I said, what were the actual LC50 values for North Carolina? And as you can see, you know, there is this, what would you might consider an apparent shift from lower LC50 values to these higher LC50 values. These are the early values that you see right here. But as we move into 2002, you can see where the values are. Now, one way that Dr. Luttrell's lab is trying to adjust for this advancing lab strain LC50 situation is they, when you see their reports more often than not now, you see that reported ratio of LC50 of the strain to the lab LC50. And so you can see when you do that, there's a lot less, the numbers are a lot smaller. You do see numbers here at the end of 35, 34, 35 fold relative to the lab response, and I can say that these are relatively high values. We've seen similar values in Georgia, in fact, as much as 100-fold, which is about as high as we've seen, and yet we can see no relationship to any problems in terms of field performance. The values that I'm talking about, if you look at this data, would be in this range right here. So there are some higher values that are 100-fold or so, these being more like 35-fold in this range. But some of the higher values are coming from the East Coast. And the point to relate back to Dr. Tabashnik's claims about a lot of refuge in North Carolina would also apply to Georgia, yet we're seeing some of the higher LC50s coming from Georgia. Well, the other thing is, if we were seeing a shift, we would think that when we picked up the LC50 work again in 2002, we would be noticing a shift from 2002 through 2005. And in fact, this is the data again from Dr. Ali, Dr. Luttrell, and you can see from this information that it certainly wouldn't look like we're seeing much of a shift, if there's any shift at all, in this time period. So, is resistance the most likely explanation for the shift? Just a few other observations, and I got this comes from Dr. Luttrell, Dr. Ali, and that is that there really is no correlation. When they find these higher LC50 values, there seems to be no correlation to time of season, crop, refuge amounts, intensity of BT acreage. It's a fairly random thing, so that would seem to indicate that this was more of the natural variation. You've got the current historical data that demonstrate that Cribin AC resistance is associated with significant fitness costs, and I want to reference a talk that Anil will be doing here at 2:45 that will very clearly delineate a lot of this. And certainly it's inconsistent with the author's interpretation of the data. And the last observation to be made here is that, you know, we've had some experience with pyrethroid resistance and the bollworm, and it's not been anything that we've yet, it's something that we can occasionally identify in some place, not in others, but it's been a very hard thing to track down in terms of saying there is a consistent trend toward pyrethroid resistance in corn earworm. It's certainly a potential that's out there, and we're following it. And again, just to remind everyone that USDA's work that's been doing, they've been doing this all along, would also confirm that resistance was not an issue. So I'd like to acknowledge these contributors to this talk and at this time conclude.
Yeah. Perfect. Thank you. Right on time. Thank you, Walt. We don't have time for questions, but we thank you very much.